Are there any questions from last time? Okay. So last time I was talking about the time-dependent harmonic oscillator, and at the end we had written down the Heisenberg picture solution for the case where the frequency is constant. If you wanted to write the Heisenberg picture position and momentum operators, then you would just attach phases to the usual Schrodinger picture expressions with the positive frequency or minus sign in the exponent on the lowering operator and the opposite sign on the raising operator. Let me point out that for this solution, the Heisenberg equations of motion are satisfied. So the Heisenberg equations of motion can always be derived formally from, this expression. But where the commutator on the right-hand side is taken in the Heisenberg picture, you can either Heisenbergize the operators before or after taking the commutator. I'll write the H here. And so just for the sake of completeness, I'll go through and show, I'll derive this Heisenberg picture equation of motion, but they always turn out to be the same as the classical equations of motion, just interpreted as operators. It's okay to combine them. Like you could say, for example, that the Heisenberg picture positions operator satisfies the second order differential equation. So just for the sake of completeness, I'll derive this expression.
I think we derive the expressions for omega equals constant only, right?
Oh yeah, right. So these, right. Yeah, this part is only for omega equals constant. These equations of motion are true for a time-dependent omega. I should have said that explicitly. Okay, so just for the sake of completeness, I'll derive the Heisenberg picture equation of motion for x. So the operator x doesn't have explicit time dependence, so I just commute it with h. And I guess I'll go do the commutator with Schrodinger picture operators and then Heisenbergize at the end. So the Hamiltonian here is going to be d squared plus squared. This term doesn't give anything. And then the first term gives minus 2ip by the canonical commutator xp equals that. Which does indeed give p. And likewise, you can show that the derivative of pH is minus omega squared times h. In general, I'll just write down the Heisenberg picture equations of motion by assuming they're the same as the classical equations of motion. Just to be clear on, as to formally how that's derived. Okay. Now, I want to generalize this to the time-dependent oscillator. In the time-dependent case, the Heisenberg picture is useful. In the time-independent case, then it's probably easier to just think about the oscillator in the Schrodinger picture. So if omega is a function of t, now I want to generalize this solution to the Heisenberg equations of motion to the case where the omega in the equations of motion depends on time. And so I think the step that is hardest to take is that I want to say that from the form of the operators at early times, remember that I'm assuming that at early times the frequency is some constant omega naught. So from this form, that this known form at early times, and the linearity of the Heisenberg equations of motion, it must be true that at all times, x and x dot are some linear combination of a and a dagger. In writing this down, I want to do one more thing too, which is I want to choose to make the a's the raising and lowering operators at the initial time, not the Schrodinger picture operators at time t. So that in general, there are, you know, three notions of lowering operator. There's the Schrodinger picture lowering operator, which is the, you know, the usual thing for an oscillator, something like not over two outside. And then there's the Heisenberg picture lowering operator, is UAS. And then there's A0, which is the Schrodinger picture operator at time zero, which is the same as the Heisenberg picture operator.
The Schrodinger picture should have omega as a function of time, not
omega. Oh, yes, yes, thank you. Yeah. I also forgot some one half. Yeah, there would be nothing wrong with writing this down with AS of T here. It's just more convenient when you use the Heisenberg picture, you're evaluating expectation values of Heisenberg operators on the initial state. So it's just more convenient to solve the Heisenberg equations of motion in terms of operators that you know, are easy to evaluate on the initial state. So I want to just start by writing this down. And the reason that's true is that if I all I'm saying in this equation is that at all times the x and p Heisenberg operators are linear combinations of a and a dagger. And my argument for why that's true is that it's true at early times by the initial solution we constructed. And then at late times, the linearity of the Heisenberg equations of motion means that you can never evolve out of this state, or evolve away from being a linear combination of these operators. Once you've written this down, then you can start to solve for the functions of time which appear. The first thing I'll note is that because x and p are Hermitian operators, B has to be U star and B has to be F star. I'll go ahead and this is great to do in the blackboard. I apologize if it's harder to take notes. Let's go ahead and make those replacements. And then the next thing I'll notice is that by the Heisenberg equation of motion, P equals X dot. F has to be U dot, and well, F star is U dot star. I'll go ahead and modify that in the blackboard. And then the last thing I'll notice is that the Heisenberg equation of motion X dot is minus omega squared P. Maybe it's easier to use the second order differential equation. Means that the function u satisfies the same equation of motion as the classical operator. The only difference being that u is a complex function of time. So I've almost solved the time-dependent oscillator in the Heisenberg picture. I've shown that there's just this ordinary differential equation that I integrate. And then I have the expression for the Heisenberg picture operators in terms of operators that are convenient to evaluate on the initial vacuum state.
Can they?
Yes?
The last equation that you wrote on the left, xh dot is omega squared.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I really mangled that. Yeah, thanks. P dot is minus omega squared x. So this is almost the solution. The only thing I need to write down are some initial conditions for the mode function u. One way to get those is just by matching up with the solution to the time independent oscillator at early times. I'm assuming that at early times, omega approaches some constant. Omega not. And so therefore, by comparing, I can see that u of t has to go to this at early times. So now I've solved the time-dependent oscillator in the sense that I've shown that if you solve this single classical differential equation, just ordinary differential equation, then I can compute whatever I want in the quantum mechanical version. For example, the question that I had asked at the beginning is, what do you get if you compute the variance of the wave function? Or the expectation value of x squared. In the Heisenberg picture, I would compute that by leaving the wave function in the initial state, which is the ground state of the oscillator by assumption, and then evaluating the expectation value of the Heisenberg picture operator. If I do that calculation, this would be u of t a naught plus u of t a naught back squared. And then this term vanishes. If I expand out, I'll get four terms, but the terms vanish where the lowering operator is applied to the ground state, the ground state ket. And over on the other side, this term vanishes where a zero dagger is applied to the ground state bra, leaving me with u times u star. This expectation value, which is equal to 1. So that the variance of the wave function or the expectation value of x squared is always the absolute square of the mode function. That was the recipe that I said I wanted to derive at the beginning. You can compute, any expectation value you want this way. Like, for example, you can show that this expectation value is equal to 3 times the fourth power of the mode function, or the absolute value of the mode function. In fact, since you can compute the expectation value of any operator, if you want, you can recover the Schrodinger wave function. And if I had more time, I'd do that computation. Let me just say that the The conclusion is that the Schrodinger wave function is Gaussian. Psi ends up being proportional to, I'll write it as e to the alpha x squared for some complex alpha, whose real part is negative, so that this is normalizable. I won't show that. I'll just say, like, in fact, the wave function is called. So the Heisenberg picture can lead to notational confusion. So I just wanted to go through one example with all the like H and S subscripts explicit. You'll often see things written with the subscripts implicit. Like you might just see an equation like this. So the X actually means XH. And the A's actually mean like initial operators. So from now on, let me say that we'll I'll only use the Heisenberg picture in examples fairly similar to this one, where I have like left-hand sides that are Heisenberg picture operators, and right-hand sides that are initial state low, raising and lowering operators. Okay, one more comment. On this example. At one point in yesterday's lecture, I had stated that the canonical commutator of X and P was equal to I in both the Heisenberg and Schrodinger pictures. In the Heisenberg picture, both operators have to be evaluated at the same time t. It's not obvious from our explicit solution why this would be true. If you compute this commutator, let me write a question mark over it. If I compute the commutator from our using the explicit solution, I get this function of t. There might appear to be no reason why that function would be equal to I, since it's just obtained by integrating this differential equation where omega can have an arbitrary time dependence. So to explain why that's true, let me give this function a name and call it W of t. In a differential equations class, you may have seen this function called the Wronskian 2x2 determinant. In general, the Wronskian of an nth order differential equation is an n by n determinant with the n independent solutions in the columns and derivatives in the rows. So you can show from the equations of motion. By the equation of motion here, I mean the differential equation for the mode function. That the derivative of W is zero, so u dot of t. And then the initial conditions that at early times, the mode function has this positive frequency form with this normalization. Imply that W is indeed equal to I at early times. So combining these observations, W must equal I at all times. So I bring this up because In more complicated examples, it can be like a useful shorthand for figuring out the normalization of the mode function at early times. We had sort of done this calculation in two steps. One where we, on the top board, where we worked out the solution for the time-independent oscillator. And then you know, we sort of started over for the time-dependent oscillator with the mode function u of t and matched to the solutions to get the right initial conditions. Another approach would have been to like start here. And then when it was time to get the initial conditions for the mode function, suppose you had remembered that the mode function should have this positive frequency form, but you didn't know what normalization A to put here. Then if you calculate the Wronskian, you get 2i omega naught times A squared. And so that calculation would tell you that the normalization A is 1 over the square root of 2 omega naught. But you can do it either way. Okay. That's it for the harmonic oscillator. And I want to start talking about QFT examples. So my first QFT example is a massless scalar field. On a constant h spacetime, non-dynamical, unlike single field inflation where both the metric and the scalar are dynamical fields. Non-dynamical constant h spacetime, meaning an FRW spacetime where the only stress energy is a cosmological constant. So then the action, I'm not including the Einstein-Hilbert action because I don't ever want to vary the metric in the action, or at least not yet. The action looks like this. If h is constant, then the metric has this FRW form. Where a is e to the ht. Remember that throughout this example, h is a constant rather than a function of t. Now it'll be, it turns out to be convenient for this example and all other examples we'll do for the next couple of days. They use conformal time. So the proper time here runs from minus infinity to infinity. In a W equals minus one cosmology, one thing we expect is that the conformal time is finite in the future and infinite in the past. Like if you draw a space-time diagram in conformal time, then reach the t equals infinity at finite conformal time. So it'll be convenient to put infinite in the past. In fact, the reason that inflation is supposed to solve the horizon problem is because it produces an infinite amount of conformal time in the past. So it'll be convenient to choose coordinates so that the conformal time goes from minus infinity to zero. I'll leave it to you to calculate the change of variables from proper time to conformal time, and show that the scale factor ends up being 1 over h tau, or rather with a minus sign since tau is negative. So the action is I'm warming up to the inflationary case. This is a space-time where W is minus one. And we saw that in single field inflation, the equation of state is always a little bit larger than minus one. I think it was minus one plus two thirds epsilon. Okay. So then the action.
That W.
Oh, in this example, W is minus one. I was just pointing out that slow roll single field inflation is like a small perturbation. Okay. So then plug again the metric. I get the square root of minus g gives a to the fourth. And g mu nu gives an a to the minus two everywhere. So in conformal time, I get d tau d3x times a squared times the action for the that you would get in Minkowski. Since I use dots for proper time, I'll try to remember to denote conformal time derivatives by partial sub tau. Or in Fourier space. In this step, I'm also plugging in 1 over h tau for the scale factor. In Fourier space, each mode phi k of the field evolves independently from the others. So this action looks very similar to, aside from this extra d3k, looks very similar to the time-dependent harmonic oscillator. The only thing that's a little different is that in the time-dependent harmonic oscillator, the coefficient of the like phi dot squared term was one, and the time dependence was all in the x squared term. And here, the time dependence is on both, so it's more like a harmonic oscillator where both the mass and the frequency are time dependent. So to make it look exactly like the time dependent harmonic oscillator, I'll change variables to what's called the canonically normalized field. And, that just is whatever field makes the coefficient of the kinetic term just equal to one. In this case, phi over h tau. I'll put k's. So I'll make that change of variables. I plug in. Plug that in then for the, I get two terms when I take the derivative. If I write phi equals h tau times psi, and then take phi, compute phi dot, I'll get two terms. One term is h tau times this derivative of psi plus h times psi. And this next line of algebra, I'll just collect terms. Next. The term with two time derivatives, in the term with two time derivatives, I've gotten rid of the time dependence as expected. And then there are some cross terms with one time derivative. There's this term. Then in the last term I've put this term with the k squared in it, and then the term here with no time derivatives. And then to simplify these middle terms, I'll integrate by parts. Like if you imagine taking this term and integrating by parts, I'll get a term where the derivative comes over here with a minus sign that cancels this term. And then a term where the derivative acts on the 1 over tau, giving me a minus 1 over tau squared. And then that probably would have been a little clearer if I'd written the subsequent line of algebra and then explained how I got it. I get an extra term, plus 1 over tau squared, from integrating by parts and differentiating over tau. Okay, so I'll write down the. I'll explain how to quantize this theory, starting with a canonically normalized field, because that's really like exactly like the harmonic oscillator. Think for like blackboard rearrangement purposes, I'm going to start over here. Mostly the difference between this example and the harmonic oscillator is just, there's an extra index k. And we have an explicit form for the time dependence rather than being some general function, omega. In the first lines, I've written the action for each of the two cases. Next, I'll write the canonical momentum. So in general, the momentum conjugate to x in Lagrangian mechanics is, or Hamiltonian mechanics is obtained by doing the partial derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to x dot, and that gives x dot. Over here, the conjugate momentum is obtained by differentiating the Lagrangian with respect to, in classical field theory, with respect to the time derivative of psi, which gives does indeed give psi dot as you would expect. But I would get something else if I had not canonically normalized. The equation of motion for, so this is both the definition of P and one of the two equations of motion. The other equation of motion over here is this. All right, I almost made the same algebra mistake. And over here, the time derivative of pi is minus k squared minus 2 over 2. Should have been tau squared. Did I make that mistake over here? No. Now when I quantize in the Heisenberg picture, I'm looking for over here some Heisenberg picture operators that satisfy the Heisenberg equations of motion and are also consistent with the canonical commutator. In the simple harmonic oscillator case, let's see, first we can write this equation, which just explains how everything is controlled by a mode function. And then let me write that down first. And I'll write the equation of motion and initial condition for the mode function shortly. Over here, the corresponding equations would say that the Heisenberg picture operator psi hat looks like some mode function which depends on k and tau. I'm going to put a subscript psi on the mode function for future use. Times some initial state lowering operator a sub k plus some the Hermitian conjugate. Here I'm going to write a minus k dagger. Why minus k instead of k? Because in the simple harmonic oscillator case, you know, x was a real variable in the classical mechanics. So with the corresponding quantum operator is Hermitian. In the QFT case, the field psi is real valued in real space, psi of x star psi of x. And if in Fourier space, that would imply that psi of k star is psi of minus k. Well, if I take the Hermitian conjugate of this operator, I should get the I shouldn't get the operator itself. I should get the operator evaluated at momentum minus k. Likewise, I hat will be I read off the coefficients of the raising and lowering operators from this equation of motion.
I think that comment that you make is for a general function. In this case, we are treating our scalar field to be real only.
Oh, yes. I was assuming that
because in the beginning we started with complex, right?
Oh, yes. Sorry, I didn't say that this was supposed to be a real scalar field.
Yeah, actually, when you do the Fourier transform, you assume that, right? Because phi minus k appears, but you wrote that phi star of k.
Oh, yes, right. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Star, yeah, sorry.
Yes, right. I meant a real scalar.
Another comment, pi should be related to psi star, right?
Sorry, say that again.
The second equation that you wrote, pi is derivative of L respect to derivative of psi, which gave us psi star, right? It should be derivative of psi star at the end, right? Ron t psi star, dt psi star.
Oh, yes, okay. Yeah, in Fourier space, so in real space, this is okay. In like if I were writing it with if you Fourier transformed it though, you would find a star here. Okay. Oh yeah, I forgot to say that now the commutator of A and A dagger has a delta function in it. The differential equation set it that you integrate to get the mode function. This follows from the equations of motion. And so over here it's does the delta squared of u. I don't know these left. Minus. And the initial conditions are the same. All right. One important point that I forgot to make is that this equation of motion at early times, where tau is close to minus infinity, is just the equation of motion for like a harmonic oscillator with no time dependence. This term, the 2 over tau squared, it comes from the expansion of the universe, and it's absent at early times. So at early times, the scalar, the canonically normalized scalar field doesn't feel the expansion of the universe, so to speak. And it has the same equation of motion as a free field in Minkowski.
So this 2 over conformal time squared, this should be a wavelength, right? And the physical meaning of it is that it kind of is determined by the expansion of the universe, right?
Oh, yes, that's true. Yeah, so one...
So is this the horizon or something like this?
Yeah.
Because the conformal time is related to the cosmological horizon, so is this... My question is basically, what is the physical meaning?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was going to say this later, but maybe I was going to do the case of a general FRW background later. But for now, let me say that. So in this space-time, there's like only one physical length scale, 1 over h, which is constant. That's like the physical Hubble radius. It's sort of a length scale for the expansion of the universe. Now, if I want to compare that to the wavelength of the mode, the mode's wavelength or wave number are fixed in co-moving coordinates. So I should compare to the co-moving Hubble radius, 1 over ah. That happens to be equal to tau, or rather minus tau, for our case of constant h. So over time, that let me write it as 1 over ah, because I think that's a more physical way of writing it. That radius is a decreasing function of decreases as the universe expands. Whereas the co-moving wave number, a to the minus 1, for some mode of interest, is constant. So there'll be some time when they cross, horizon crossing. And the physics of the mode simplifies in the limits where you're well before horizon crossing or well after horizon crossing. Before horizon crossing, if you use psi, instead of phi, Then the equation of motion is just the same as a free field in Minkowski. The intuition there is that the Hubble radius is just much larger than the wavelength of the mode. So that when the mode like talks to itself and oscillate, it doesn't feel the expansion of the universe. At late times, when the wavelength of the mode is much larger than the Hubble radius, the mode, different parts of the mode are causally disconnected from each other, and the mode is frozen. It can't oscillate anymore. I didn't actually write down the equation of motion, but you'll see that the equation of motion becomes even simpler. It just says that phi is constant at late times. At horizon crossing, we'll see that a quantum mechanical perturbation is generated, and then this late time behavior freezes it in, so to speak. Okay.
Perturbations are generated at the horizon crossing time, and then they remain frozen.
Yes.
After they are out of the Hubble horizon.
Yeah, that's right. Once the wavelength of the mode is, it'll be easier to see when I have a few more equations on the board. At these late times, when the wavelength of the mode is larger than the Hubble horizon, then the mode gets frozen by, maybe the best way to say it is that it's frozen by Hubble friction. Okay. So then the initial conditions, I think it's pretty intuitive physically to say that you, for this canonically normalized field where at early times the physics is just Minkowski, or K mode, the same as the harmonic oscillator. To say that the initial condition should be the same as a just as the usual harmonic oscillator. If you wanted to check that, a nice check is to compute the canonical commutator of psi and its momentum pi. You'll get this Wronskian determinant. Times a delta function in the case. And then you can show that the equation of motion for the mode function guarantees that the Wronskian determinant is constant in time. And that only if you choose this normalization does it end up being equal to I. So there's more than one way of getting this. One difference relative to the simple harmonic oscillator case is that it turns out that this differential equation with this initial condition has an exact solution, a simple analytic solution, which I'll write down. I put k0 here, but that doesn't. I meant to just write k. This is hard to find.
Why did you drop the zero in k0?
So over here, omega zero meant the frequency of the oscillator, which was assumed constant at early times. But over here, k is just the wave number of the mode whose mode function is computed.
So k is just under root of 3k, means kx squared, ky squared, kz squared.
Yeah. So it's constant in time, and there's no like difference between k0 and k.
I see.
I don't have a good way to derive this. I guess someone just found the solution at some point and put it into a paper, and then everyone copied it, but I don't know who gets credit.
So k zero was the wavelength that, let's say, past infinity or something like this at some specific time, and now we're saying that we're studying one particular mode that has a wavelength k, so this is why we drop the k zero. We just study.
Oh yes, yes, that's right. Yeah, I'm expanding the field in Fourier modes and co-moving wave number.
I'm studying one of the Fourier modes.
Yeah, yeah, and then this mode function is tracking the evolution of one value of k. Okay. Of course, it's easy to verify that this mode function satisfies this differential equation condition. Well, that's the. So this is the complete solution to this QFG. So it looks divergent. The mode function diverges at tau equals zero. But this is really just an artifact of changing variables from phi to psi equals phi over h tau. It's convenient to use psi as the field variable at early times, like before horizon crossing, and phi as the field variable at late times after horizon crossing. At late times, I can write down the solution by just multiplying this expression for psi by h tau. I'll introduce mode functions. I'm going to write that in terms of a new mode function, but I'm just defining u phi to be h tau times u psi. And is h. As a comment, you don't really need to change variables to psi. I just like to do it that way because the analogy with the harmonic oscillator is a little clearer. In the psi variable, or in the phi variable, then the normalization would work out like this. Now the conjugate momentum is a factor of h tau squared in it. I'm not showing a few lines of algebra here. I just wanted to make the comment that if you wanted to quantize the theory in the phi variable, then you would end up with mode functions that satisfy the equation of motion for phi. I'll write that down too. In the phi variable, the equation of motion looks like this. And then when you got to the initial conditions, then the canonical commutator would give you a factor of h in the normalization, which is where the h comes from. Okay. I'll calculate the size of the fluctuations at late times. I guess at any time. Here I'm going to use the, I probably shouldn't have used psi for both the field and the wave function. I'm going to calculate the expectation value of phi squared. Like a so e totally precise about what I'm computing. In the Schrodinger picture, you would write it like this. This theory has some wave function at time tau. And I decided to calculate the expectation value of phi in Fourier mode k times phi star in Fourier mode k prime. And I'm just going to immediately convert that to the Heisenberg picture. I'm assuming that this quantum mechanical theory starts out in its ground state. Like at early times, before any modes have crossed the horizon, this just looks like a bunch of harmonic oscillators in Minkowski. I'm just assuming that all those oscillators are in their ground state. That's what's called the Bunch-Davies vacuum, and it's sort of like the simplest initial conditions for a QFT in an expanding space time. And immediately switch to the Heisenberg picture and calculate this by again, Heisenberg picture operators at time t. Here I'll have a Hermitian conjugate. Here, for the first factor, I get u phi ak. A minus k dagger. Here I'll get taking the Hermitian conjugate. So I have k prime. I'll put the star on the u and then a dagger on the k. Minus k prime. This term is zero because I have a lowering operator applied to a vacuum ket. And this term is zero since I have a raising operator acting on the to the right of a vacuum rock. Times this. And then this gives by the canonical commutator for raising and lowering operators. I hope you all can see the last line. I don't know, the podium's in the way. Let me just continue over here. So that equation is true at any time tau. At late times, after all modes of interest have crossed the horizon, set tau to zero. The size of the fluctuations of this two-point function given by evaluating the phi mode function at tau equals zero. From our explicit expression for the mode function, this is h squared over 2k cubed. So we're getting close to I motivated the initial discussion of inflation by saying that the metric perturbations in the hot Big Bang should have a two-point correlation that looks almost exactly like this, with nearly 1/k³ scale dependence. That does this so-called scale invariant form does come out naturally in this example. The size of the fluctuations is proportional to h squared. So the expansion rate of the universe is setting the size of the quantum mechanically generated perturbation.
So 1/k³ has, how is it related to scale invariance?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So if I have a random field whose two-point function is proportional to 1/k³, then that has the following physical meaning. If I zoom in on a little subvolume, if I have a realization of the field in a box, a random realization, and then I zoom in on a sub-box and magnify it to the size of the original box, then it looks statistically indistinguishable from the original field. That comes out of just the transformation law for Fourier transforms. If you like, you can transform phi under a rescaling and show that the two-point function is rescaling invariant if it has this form. As a shortcut to doing that calculation, you can use like dimensional analysis. So in this case, phi is a scalar field with dimensions of mass. The h here also has dimensions of mass. But if it were a dimensionless field, you know, then this would, you know, be a 1. Or if it were a dimensionless field, if I write the coefficient as a, the delta function carries units of, you know, its inverse argument. So the delta function here would have units of volume that would. So it's only, sorry, I'm saying this badly. If phi is dimensionless, then the Fourier transform has units of volume, length cubed. The 1/k³ would also have dimensions of volume. And then the delta function would have dimensions of volume. So that the A here would have, would be dimensionless, only if the denominator here scales as k³. If it were any other power, then the A would have to be a dimensionful quantity and there would be some scale in the correlation.
What is the exactly physical quantity that we observed and has this, I don't know, correlation?
Oh, yeah, right. What we actually observe is like the correlation function of the CMB. You can think of the CMB, it would take a long time to like explain all the physics, but you can think of the CMB as sort of like a big linear operator that forms the pixels of the CMB temperature out of the initial metric. We know the physics of that operator pretty well. It's like the linear perturbation theory in the plasma between the hot Big Bang and when the CMB is generated. So it's possible to statistically invert it. The two power spectra, you know, the power spectrum from the CMB is some complicated thing with like acoustic peaks and a damping tail. All that structure is just imprinted by the physics of like sound waves in the plasma between the Big Bang and when the CMB is formed. And if you invert it, you can reconstruct the power spectrum or the two-point function of the initial perturbations. And it's almost perfectly consistent with a 1/k³. It has a little bit more power on large scales. So I'll draw the actual, the 1/k³ looks like this. The power spectrum of the initial perturbations in our universe are a little bit tilted toward large scales or low k. But the exponent here is something like 1/ k to the 3, right, it's 1 k to the minus 3 plus a number around 0.04.
So we observe CMB in different direction, and we like kind of assign I don't know, distance to, length parameter. Then in Fourier space, it has this correlation, something like that.
Yeah, right. There's like a lot of Fourier transforms between what we actually measure and this plot.
Yeah, but direction, right?
Yeah, right. So what you would like one way of thinking about. So first, let me simplify a little bit, and let's pretend that the sky is not a sphere, but a flat sky, like a 2D periodic box. Then you know, the CMB temperature in real space would be some field T of x, and in Fourier space would be some field T of l. Cosmologists are hardwired to use L in two dimensions and K in three dimensions. I'm sorry about that. And then what you could compute is the two-point function of the CMB. It'd be some power spectrum, or some there'd be some prefactor of the delta function here, denoted C sub L. And that's what you see, like if you've seen a plot of the CMB power spectrum, that's what's being plotted. It's estimated from measuring the CMB and then computing the size of the Fourier modes as a function of scale. The only thing that this description leaves out is that you know, the CMB is actually observed on a spherical sky. The analog of the Fourier transform on a sphere is the spherical harmonic transform. And so this plot is really a plot of like the size of the spherical harmonic coefficients as a function of their spherical wave number. So that's like what you directly observe from the CMB, more or less, is like the size of the fluctuations as a function of a 2D wave number L. And then that in turn, because the formation of the CMB is linear, in the initial conditions, can be translated to a measurement of the power spectrum or the size of the initial 3D fluctuations as a function of their wave number k. There's some linear operator that's more or less mapping like, you know, one value of k onto a closely related value of L. That just has to do with how far the CMB is, plus some you know, multiplicative factor that controls the amount of growth of the mode between the initial conditions and recombination.
So in this means what we've shown is that if we put a scalar field in the FRW background, we get a scale invariant power spectrum.
Yeah, exactly.
That's okay.
Yeah.
But we haven't shown means the scalar field, the inflaton field is different, right? Means for that we solve. We also have one more equation, which is Einstein's equation.
That's right. Yeah. So the action of single field inflation. So in single field inflation, the action looks like this. Let me start by just writing. Here's the action we talked about today. Maybe real space is better. Single field inflation would appear to be a lot more complicated because the like metric is dynamical. We showed that at the end of the day, you end up with ignoring the gravity wave degrees of freedom. You end up with something like this. That's squared over h squared. End up with this field zeta. Um, which has a nearly the same action. It's just a different time-dependent factor in front. So even though the theory is like, you know, one contains a dynamical metric and one doesn't, and there are gauge issues and so on, the actual actions don't end up being very different.
I see. But this field is CMB field, right? We assume CMB has a field that's vague, and we assign a field and try to write action for that and find the evolution, right? This doesn't have anything to do with inflation. Inflation field, or
yeah. Oh yeah, so this field was just kind of a warm up to talking about inflation. But it's not going to end up being very different. Yeah, I just wanted to start with a non-dynamical constant H metric, and then an action which doesn't have a potential or anything. It's just like a minimally coupled massless scalar. And then what you end up with is this two-point correlation, which is perfectly scale invariant, whose overall amplitude is easy to interpret. It's just the Hubble expansion rate that the field experiences as it crosses the horizon. Inflation will be a little more complicated, but not much.
So the two-point functions that will describe the power spectrum in case of inflation would be now, because of all our degrees of freedom we have put in the zeta, setting delta phi to be zero in our gauge. So in that case, zeta, the two-point function would be like zeta k, zeta k prime.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So then the two-point function that we'll compute at the end will be the two-point function of this variable zeta. Which is like a little bit counterintuitive to interpret. It's like the fluctuation in the trace part of the spatial metric in a gauge where you use the inflaton as the clock.
I think we should leave the place for the
Yeah, I know, we're going.